The Tom Woods Show, episode 667.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm all by myself today doing an episode on an article from The Guardian that I should have done a while ago, and I meant to do it. I don't know how it slipped my mind. I got so many requests from people to smash this article, so I feel bad that it's so late. The article is from mid-April, and as I'm talking to you, it's May 24th, 2016. So better late than never, but I'm sorry about this. I honestly don't know how I went this long without doing it. So it's just my mistake, but here we go doing it. The article is by a guy named George Monbiot, and it's called Neoliberalism, the Ideology at the Root of All Our Problems. Of course, I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/667. Monbiot writes for The Guardian regularly. He's involved in almost any left-wing cause you can imagine. And he's writing this piece on neoliberalism. Now, neoliberalism is a word that as soon as you hear it, you know the person using it is a propaganda artist. You know that for a fact. Because you don't describe yourself as a neoliberal. I don't know anybody who calls himself that. I've never called myself a neoliberal. It's a ridiculous term that was invented basically as a term of derision. So anytime somebody is going to try to do a study of a school of thought and calls it something that members of that school of thought don't even use, he attributes to them a term they don't use to describe themselves. So you know that person is a scammer, basically, an intellectual scammer. But neoliberal, that is, I mean, there should be alarm bells going off when you hear neoliberal. You know that the person saying it is a scam artist and doesn't understand what it is he's talking about. Now, I do understand what progressives are saying, and I know the differences between them, and I know that counterpunch.org is not the same thing as Hillary Clinton, and I know that there are people, that the new left, for example, the 1960s, is different from the old left. And I know that there are differences between somebody like Camille Paglia and Eric Foner. I know and understand these differences perfectly well. Whereas in my experience on the other side, there is either a refusal to understand or simply an ignorance that there could be anything different among people who happen to be from Bob Dole rightward. That all those people are more or less interchangeable, so there's nothing interesting about that. To me, that's extremely interesting, right? The fact that there are neoconservatives who could be so different from me, even though we're both, in principle anyway, anti-communist, and we have these other things in common, and we both don't like the Democrats and so on, that we could be so different. I find that quite interesting, and somebody like Monbiot is not interested in distinctions like this at all. So what a shame he lives in such a crummy world. But anyway, when I was digging up his article so I could talk to you about it, I discovered that somebody's already written a really good response to Monbiot, and that person is Juan Ramon Rallo, and I'm going to link to his response also at tomwoods.com/667. I actually, Rallo, by the way, is a young economist. He is certainly one of the most prominent and brightest young Spanish-speaking Austrian economists. I had a chance to meet him very briefly in Madrid several years ago. So I'm going to also refer to his response to Monbiot as I zip through this article with you. So I'm going to try not to have this be a 10-hour episode, but I'm telling you, each one of the subheadings could be an episode of its own, and maybe, you know, maybe someday I will do something like that. Now, of course, the term neoliberalism is never defined in the article. Of course, we have no idea what it is, but we just know that it's terrible, and we don't need to define it. So we don't actually know what it is. Now, when I have heard the term used, it's used to refer to like the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. These are neoliberal institutions. Well, let's see. Given that they're funded by tax dollars and staffed by bureaucrats, probably not. And given that they are enforcing half the time mercantilist policies, probably not. So this is just so annoying, the refusal to make distinctions. But he also says that Mises and Hayek are neoliberals. So Mises and Hayek, who argued that the whole business cycle is caused by interfering with interest rates artificially, but yet every neoliberal that who I've met who actually maybe might fit the term supports central banking. Oh, they're free market. You know the type. They're free market people, but they support 27 interventions, including central banking. Those people, I think, might be neoliberals if you wanted to use a stupid term like that. But obviously, Mises and Hayek don't belong in that category. So basically, the article goes through and says, all our problems are caused by neoliberalism, a term I refuse to define, but which is sort of like vaguely libertarianism. And Mises and Hayek, yeah, they were part of that. It's so stupid. Mises and Hayek want to abolish the very institutions that both Monbiot and the neoliberals think are essential to the economy. It's extremely annoying. Extremely annoying. Maybe Jack Kemp might have been a neoliberal in that sense. But even still, what a stupid term. Just call people by the names they want to be called. If they want to be called capitalists, call them capitalists. They want to be called libertarians, call them libertarians. What's the problem here? All right, anyway, let's go through. Neoliberalism, here's the first thing we learn. Neoliberalism sees competition as the defining characteristic of human relations. Okay, well, given that he's calling Mises and Hayek neoliberals, I'm going to assume that he's trying to say libertarianism, but either doesn't know how to use the word or what. Because if he's calling Mises and Hayek them, then I'm going to assume he's trying to say capitalism, the free market, libertarianism. And you can imagine somebody saying capitalism, the free market, libertarianism, that they believe that competition is the defining characteristic of human relations. What they actually believe is that nobody should aggress against anybody else. That's what they actually believe. Whatever follows from that maybe follows from that, but the primary point of view, the primary view being put forth by libertarians, is that there shouldn't be aggression against peaceful people. That's it. Anything else about competition or whatever is entirely secondary, if even that, to this primary observation. Now, that is a very attractive idea, that nobody should initiate aggression against peaceful people. That does sound like a very attractive idea, which is why critics of it never state it that way. They don't want people to hear it stated that way. They want to hear it as, these people believe in dog-eat-dog capitalism. They believe in crushing their competitors, and blah, 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 blah. That's why they talk that way, to make it sound really unattractive. But libertarians believe no such thing. And even, quote, neoliberals, whatever this stupid term is supposed to be. And I'm sorry, I don't think I can use the word term without the word stupid in front of it to refer to neoliberals. Maybe it's either I'm in a foul mood today, maybe this thing put me in a foul mood, or it's just a dumb term. I'm sorry. Anyway, is it even true? Well, let's think about it here. What's really going on in the free market? It's true that there is some competition. One firm is competing with another firm for your consumer dollar. But what is really happening? What are they competing for? They're competing to see who can serve you better. Isn't that the best conceivable kind of competition? There are all sorts of competition you can think of, athletic, intellectual, all kinds of competition. But a competition to see who can serve you better. Who can provide you with the best medical services, the best educational services, the best books, the best, barbershop services, the best whatever, the best consumer products, the best food. They're competing to see who can give you the best. That's bad? Is there a reason we should think that's bad? But on another level, on a higher level, on a level where you have to go beyond the surface, you have to be able to see beyond superficialities. In fact, capitalism is the greatest latticework of cooperation in the history of the world. Because think about it, we can think in terms of the old example of the pencil that we got initially from Leonard Reed and then from Milton Friedman. The example of the pencil and all the different things that go into creating a pencil, and it's not just the raw materials that go into it, but it's the capital goods necessary to extract the raw materials. It's the goods necessary to create the capital goods that you use to extract the raw materials. It's the gasoline that you have to refine in order to fuel the trucks that will transport the different parts of the pencil. There's all kinds of different things that go into the production of just a pencil. And what in fact is happening there is an extraordinary example of human cooperation. Because the firm that produces the lumber is in implicit cooperation with the firm producing the paint and the firm that goes and gets the graphite, and they all wind up selling their intermediate goods to each other so that they can go on and ultimately be combined into a pencil. And they are all working together. The disruption of this supply chain would be disruptive to everybody. So it is a cooperation. Otherwise, how precisely would you go about organizing a global, worldwide project like pencil production by simply asking everybody, listen, if you have some time at 4 o'clock, we're going to all try and produce the various inputs for a pencil at that time. If you could all just go ahead and be there. Doesn't work. Doesn't work. You need private property owners who are trying to support themselves, who decide, let's produce things that are urgently needed by the consumers, and they figure out from the structure of consumer demand what those things are and where they, the capitalists, are best suited to place themselves within the structure of production in order to produce what the consumers demand most urgently. And the result is, without anyone having to force anybody to do anything, without anyone shouting through a bullhorn at anybody, you get this tremendous example of worldwide cooperation among people who may not speak the same language, practice the same religion, observe the same customs, be of the same race, and yet they're all producing inputs that will combine together for this glorious product that you and I take for granted. That's a wonderful thing. Now, if you're just going to look at it superficially, like a 7-year-old, you would say, this is dog-eat-dog competition. But actually, we've never, up until the modern market economy was created, we've never been able to have cooperation on a global scale. We've never been able to see the division of labor extended to quite this degree. And this is cooperation. This is cooperation in the best sense of the word. And in fact, if all you had, if you had no competition, and instead all you had was the government running everything or one big firm running everything, so that there could be no competition, and that George Monbiot would be happy. The problem is, you couldn't have economic calculation, and civilization would revert to barbarism. I'll link on the show notes page to the episodes we've done on the socialist calculation problem. But as we've seen, when we've talked about this, the key problem with classical socialism, the socialism where you have government ownership of the means of production, government ownership of the factories, the capital goods, the raw material deposits, and so on. When you have government ownership of those things, here's the problem. If prices are to emerge, you need private property owners, because prices emerge through all the different buying and selling that occurs on the market. You basically have bids and counterbids until eventually the market settles on a price. Now, without these prices, we would not be able to make rational economic decisions. We would not be able to determine what use of a particular capital good is the most urgently needed use. We would be putting capital goods to the service of goods that are not so urgently demanded, that might be ludicrous to produce. So when you're faced with an input of lumber and rubber and steel and concrete, and you can combine them in all different ratios to produce this same output, how do you know what ratio is the optimal one so that you don't waste the resources? Because there are other production processes that would also like to use those resources. Well, how do you know which process is the most urgently demanded? And so maybe in this other process that really needs concrete, maybe that means that in my process, I should try to conserve on concrete so that this other process that can only use concrete gets extra concrete. Well, how would I know that without prices? How could I compare? How could I calculate? How could I think in terms of profit and loss unless I had a way to take all these incommensurable goods and think of them in terms of a common unit, namely a money unit or a dollar? How would I be able to decide what is the more demanded thing? Or how would I be able to decide between different production processes, different combinations? There'd be no way. And so the result would be ridiculous economic decision-making and destructive economic decision-making. And this would be true whether we were dealing with a government owning all the means of production or a single firm, one big firm, controlling everything. They would not be able to make these calculations. In order to make these calculations, you need buying and selling, which gives rise to prices, and prices are the indispensable ingredient in entrepreneurial appraisal. What you need is competition for all the different resources. You need all the different resources being pulled in all different directions, and then the extent of the pull, in effect, decides who gets it. Because who gets it is the firm that's got the most overwhelming consumer demand for the final product. So they're able to command the capital goods and the raw materials necessary to create that final product. But without those different pulls by different property owners, how, in a non-arbitrary way, would we allocate all those resources? So thank goodness it's not all one giant cooperative enterprise. We wouldn't be able to have economic calculation. We wouldn't be able to make rational decisions. So check out the episodes on the socialist calculation problem and see why it is that having a variety of private property owners, each with his own plans and his own intentions for the different capital goods, the different raw materials, that's what helps us to allocate resources and not be completely in the dark about it. And this is why, by the way, in Mises' book Liberalism, and of course by liberalism he means classical liberalism, which is closer to libertarianism, of course, than it is to modern liberalism, Mises says, human society is an association of persons for cooperative action. Precisely. Then we get from Monbiot, neoliberalism, again, we'll say libertarianism because that's what we do prefer to be called, maintains that the market delivers benefits that could never be achieved by planning. Well, Rollo's response is exactly what my response would be, which is that we're not against planning, we're against the centralization of planning. Of course you have to plan. Who doesn't plan? The point is, why should we have one power center making plans for everybody? Not only does that rob people of their freedom, but it also leads to all kinds of economic chaos. When you have a central plan imposed on society, there are all kinds of problems associated with that. And one of them, of course, is that the planners wouldn't even have, if it's classical socialism, they wouldn't even have prices to go on. So they'd be planning without the most important ingredient in planning, which is prices that help you to evaluate different courses of action and their profitability, which means how well they satisfy the consumer. So, of course, we believe in individual planning. So this is like saying libertarians believe that when there's a depression, we shouldn't do anything about it. Well, what do you mean by we? The government should stay out, but individuals absolutely should do things. They should try to reprice assets, try to figure out what the real values of things are now that the real factors and the real conditions are now revealed, now that the bubble prices have burst. Now we can try to reprice things and try to rebuild our economy over again. Of course, we need individuals to do that. We just don't want a group of people with guns to impose a plan on everybody. That's all. All right, next. Inequality is recast as virtuous, a reward for utility and a generator of wealth which trickles down to enrich everyone. All right, well, of course, again, the term trickle down is not a term. I've never heard anyone who supports the market economy use the term trickle down. So again, they're using their own term of abuse and then applying it to us and then laughing at it. But we never said that. On the other hand, well, what has in fact happened over the past 200 years? Has not pretty much everyone been enriched? And didn't most of this enrichment occur long before there were welfare states to take the credit for it? So somehow, people were enriched. And of course, obviously I'm enriched when somebody invests in capital equipment and can produce now 1 million computers instead of 100. Because now I can get a computer for $500 instead of $5,000. Of course I'm enriched by that. Why wouldn't I be? Of course I'm enriched by that. No, it doesn't mean, how crude do we have to be here? It doesn't mean that a big hand comes out of the sky and gives me a check for $4,500. No, I will grant you that that doesn't happen, that little water droplets containing money don't drop onto my head, so it doesn't trickle down to me in that way. I'll grant that. But in the form of greater abundance and therefore lower prices vis-a-vis wages, that absolutely does trickle down to me. There's no question about that. What the heck did I do to contribute to the fall in prices of computers, right? I didn't do anything to contribute to that. Somebody must have done it. So obviously it was those people, those virtuous people who are unequal and who had more money than I did. Yes, I will grant that. I think that's great. Good for them. Thank you very much for doing that. Let's see. I think I'll skip that one because I can't believe how much time I'm spending on these. I said I wasn't going to take this much time, and I'm spending 5 years on each one. Then he says that libertarians, in libertarianism, of course he says stupid neoliberalism, the organization of labor and collective bargaining by trade unions are portrayed as market distortions. Well, that is true. They are market distortions. That impede the formation of a natural hierarchy of winners and losers. All right, show me a libertarian who ever said, the reason I don't like labor unions is that they are getting in the way of the formation of a natural hierarchy of winners and losers. I'm a libertarian, so I need there to be created a bunch of losers that I can feel better than and superior to. And labor unions are getting in the way of the creation of that hierarchy of winners and losers. We've never said that. Where's he getting this? It's like they believe their own crazy rhetoric about capitalism and greed and whatever. A natural hierarchy of winners and losers. We can't let you workers or unionize, or otherwise, how are we going to tell who the losers are? I mean, who has ever thought that, much less said it? All right. And incidentally, it is worth noting that Frédéric Bastiat, now you know him, if you're a listener of this show, chances are. If not, you should read him. He was an early to mid-19th century French political economist and writer. Frédéric Bastiat was a great libertarian, and he argued in favor, as Rollo points out, he argued in favor of the legalization of trade unions in the French Parliament. And there were opponents of his who wanted to penalize labor unions, but he said there's a natural right of association. They have a right to associate. Libertarians all believe in this natural right to associate. All we're against is the use of violence. You can't use violence. You can't hurl brickbats at people. You can't blow up housing where non-union workers are living. You can't throw broken glass at people, whatever. I mean, these are all things that have actually happened and been connived at by governments that don't want to put a stop to them. That's what we're against. You can do whatever you want. Go ahead. Start a labor union. Knock yourself out. But don't knock other people out. That's our point. Through the IMF, the World Bank, and so on, neoliberal policies were imposed on much of the world. And again, okay, well, we're against the IMF and the World Bank, so this apparently he thinks that if it's got money in the title, or bank, this means it's capitalist, because capitalism involves money, or I don't know, but we're against these things. Then he says that the term neoliberalism was coined at a meeting in Paris in 1938. Among the delegates were two men who came to define the ideology, Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek. They did not coin that term, and they did not accept that term. They did not use that term, to my knowledge. So this is simply meant to confuse matters, to make people think that Mises and Hayek would have supported the World Bank and their policies. Obviously, Mises and Hayek actually favored a free market. Hayek, most of the time, actually favored a free market, which would not have a World Bank. So Monbiot is just, this is what I mean. I understand what Monbiot's views are, but he honestly, he doesn't see any problem with, on the one hand, saying neoliberalism, one of its greatest, I mean, the guy who came to define neoliberalism was Ludwig von Mises. And boy, neoliberalism, it sure is imposing all kinds of terrible policies through the World Bank. Why would Mises have supported a government monstrosity like that? See, Mises was more libertarian, I guess, than Monbiot realizes. Apparently we are much, much worse than he ever dreamed. He couldn't even conceive of what our views are. All right, let's see. I'm going to skip that one. He says that the financial meltdown of 2007-08, that was, of course, caused by, what was it caused by? Come on, everybody. You're driving in your car. Say the word. Say it. Say it. Neoliberalism. You got it. Very good. All right. Because as you know, Misesian and Hayekian ideas have been triumphant all over the world for decades. They think because Ronald Reagan was president that all of a sudden we had a laissez-faire economy. Okay, the federal budget doubled. Taxes on net went up. The number of regulations, you know, in some areas, there was deregulation, but it was unambiguously a good thing. But in other areas, you still had this gigantic federal register with a huge number of regulations. You didn't have, and the most regulated sector was the banking sector, by far. So I've talked on the show a whole bunch of times about what really caused the financial crisis, so we'll link to those. Let me write these down. Where's my pen? All right, economic calculation. And we're going to talk about, what am I linking to? What was I just talking about here? Financial crisis, right, financial crisis. I'll put those episodes up. But financial crisis had a teensy-weensy bit to do with central banks. And guess what? Guess how many references to central banks there are in George Monbiot's article. Oh, why would I take the fun out of all the counting you'll be doing? Wouldn't want to do that. So, you can count those for yourselves. Whole bunch of references, as you can bet. Whole bunch of references to central banking in there. All right, then the collapse of public health and education. That's neoliberalism, he says. All right, well, let's see. Education, certainly the money has been there. I can speak for the U.S. The money has been there. Money has doubled over the past generation or so, and the results are terrible. And the kids wind up graduating, they have no idea where they're going to, what they're going to do, or they just know they got to go to college. That's what they know. They know nothing else. They have no idea how to support themselves. And there's all the money in the world, all the money in the world. And plus, all you need is chalkboard and chalk. You need a chalkboard and some chalk. That's not that expensive. You need a teacher. It's really not that expensive. So you could do it on much, much less money than they have now. They've gotten plenty of money, and the results are terrible. Well, public health, I mean, Monbiot has gotten what he wanted on that, right? The whole world practically is going toward the government running that, so that's where his gripe is. Then he says, he talks about child poverty. Like child poverty is something we need to account for. No, what we need to account for is wealth. Everybody's born into poverty. I mean, initially, before we had the explosion of wealth that the free market made possible, poverty was the norm. Poverty didn't require an explanation. That's what everybody's born into. What requires an explanation is wealth, is escaping poverty. That's what you have to explain. Poverty's not hard to explain. It's the natural condition of the human race. What's miraculous is that we got to a point where we even noticed it. You don't notice something that's absolutely ubiquitous and seems to be an unchangeable feature of life. But we began to notice it, as Hayek says, precisely because we began to make headway against it thanks to the wealth created by the free market. And then it came to seem intolerable to us because we knew that it could be eradicated. Now, let me read Rollo here. Rollo's comment on child poverty as a result of neoliberalism. He says, child poverty is closely linked to unemployment. In Spain, for instance, poverty itself is a result of unemployment. What is the cause of unemployment? To begin with, there is a financial crisis, which, as explained above, is not a consequence of market liberalism, but was rather caused by the privileges which the state gave to private banks. But there's another type of unemployment, that caused by state regulation. States design labor regulations that are supposed to protect the worker. But the real effect of those regulations is to increase the costs of hiring to such a degree that the worker can only join the growing army of the unemployed. This leaves the worker without any real hope of advancing professionally, and this is the hotbed of child poverty. The way to get rid of child poverty, Rollo continues, is to create employment, and creating jobs requires a free labor market, not a hyper-regulated labor market. Contrary to what Monbiot argues, granting more privileges to labor unions will not end the problem. It will rather make things worse because it'll make hiring more expensive. Measures such as an increase in salaries without taking productivity into account, an arbitrary reduction in working hours, or a prohibition on firing workers can only increase unemployment. Then, of course, we get the usual stuff about inequality, inequality of income and wealth. Now, that's a topic we've covered on Contra Krugman, my other podcast, so I'll link to the episode that we did on inequality. But I'll just note a couple of things that are interesting points that Rollo makes in response to Monbiot. He says, the increase in inequality during the last decades has varied and complex causes. Monbiot simply blames, quote, the smashing of trade unions, tax reductions, rising rents, privatization, and deregulation. The truth, however, is that inequality began to rise in the 1970s, when none of what Monbiot describes was taking place. Whoops. Too bad for Monbiot. On the other hand, and I'm reading, continuing with Rollo, if inequality results from a widening gap between skilled and unskilled workers, it is evident that a deficient state education system must share a large part of the blame. This is the case since state education tends to focus on making students university graduates, but a university education does not always prepare a person to adapt to the modern world's constant changes. We should be trying to prepare professionals, whether university educated or not, who are able to join our changing and dynamic labor markets. And then he says, we should not fall into the trap of assuming that market liberalism necessarily creates inequality, and that this implies poverty for an important part of society. The liberalization of global commerce, in fact, is reducing global inequality and poverty at a rate never seen previously in human history. That's another good point about inequality, is that global inequality, if you look in terms of countries, has declined sharply in recent decades. Now, that's not supposed to happen, according to Monbiot's view, and yet there it is happening right before his eyes. Then we get a whole thing about the environment, the collapse of ecosystems because of capitalism. Well, it's actually because of a failure by government to enforce private property. Obviously, people will engage in environmental degradation if they bear no cost in doing so. So that's the problem. So I will, let's jot down environment. Let's get any environmental episodes. Put those up there. Had a few of those. It's going to be a juicy show notes page, tomwoods.com/668. Oh boy, is this going to be a goodie. All right. Then we get the epidemic of loneliness. Loneliness because of the individualism of neoliberalism. Now, I will simply point out that, again, libertarianism just says don't commit aggression against anybody else. That's all it says. It says nothing about, it actually doesn't say anything about individualism. You can belong to groups and clubs and associations and families and churches and civic organizations, and you can do all these things. Just try not to, you know, punch people in the face. That's basically what we're saying. Nothing, that's it. Just try not to, that's not hard for us, for those of us who are libertarians, but it's like some crazy view for people like Monbiot. So he says, yeah, oh, it's caused loneliness and, you know, all kinds of social problems because it's just this dog-eat-dog individualism. But the exact opposite is the truth, because what institution in society most fears competing power centers, if not the state? That was the thesis of Robert Nisbet in his book, The Quest for Community, a book I highly recommend. And here's what Monbiot, I beg your pardon, this is Rollo's response, which is exactly right. He says, the state has always been suspicious of the family, of municipal authority, of churches and voluntary associations. In certain cases, the state has absorbed some of these groups, transforming municipalities into yet another one of its administrative branches, or in many countries, making the state itself the official religion. In other cases, the state, by means of welfare programs, has sought to replace groupings such as the family or friendly societies. That's, friendly societies are from the UK. Mutual associations that take care of minors and the elderly while providing education, insurance against risk, and social services. It's surprising that once the state fragments and weakens society's cooperative ties, except in strictly mercantile spheres where the market still operates, the statists complain because society itself and the old networks of cooperation are disappearing. The truth is that the state has annihilated associations in order to strengthen its monopoly of power. All right, that's a decent reply to the Monbiot piece. We could go a lot farther than this, but I think this is as much as I want to do for one episode. This is going to have a lot of previous episodes linked on it, and I'm also going to link to the article itself and to the Rollo response. All of those things are at tomwoods.com/668. Now, before I tell you about tomorrow, I'll tell you a quick thing coming up. So this is May 24th, 2016, coming up in 3 days, May 27th, starting at 12:01 a.m. I mean, like at the very, very beginning of May 27th. It's still going to be May 26th in some time zones. But May 27th, New York time, 12:01 a.m., our old friends at Rocket Languages are having a 60% off sale. You got to use the word memorial as the coupon code to get 60% off. It's a ridiculous deal. These are excellent language programs. If you've been meaning to learn a foreign language, grab the program, put it on your Google Calendar, 12:01 a.m., the first 1,000 courses they sell will be at 60% off. These go so fast. You got to set your alarm for 12:01 a.m., on Friday the 27th, grab yourself one of these courses over at tomwoods.com/rocket and use code MEMORIAL to get 60% off. I find out about these sales in advance because the Tom Woods Show is an affiliate of Rocket Languages, so I give you the opportunity to get in there and grab these courses before other people do, right? Let's let you guys get it. Maybe I'm just an evil neoliberal in some ways by giving you this information. So the sale could go on for a few days, but if they sell all 1,000 courses, you're out of luck. So you got to hurry up. And on Friday, the 27th, grab your course through tomwoods.com/rocket. All right, tomorrow, you are absolutely going to love episode 668 because I got David Henderson back, and I've already recorded it, so I can tell you. He came on to talk about how an economist can shed light on why non-interventionism in foreign policy is a good idea. And we talked about that, but I threw some curveballs at him that he wasn't expecting, and it just made for such a fun and just an interesting and engaging and challenging episode. I just loved it. And then afterward, we just talked for another 20 minutes, had a great time. I should have recorded that. That was at least as good as the rest of the show. So definitely, definitely, definitely check out episode 668. And I think that's it. Also, if people are having trouble with the FeedBurner feed for the show, don't use the FeedBurner feed. FeedBurner is from hell. You don't want to use FeedBurner. You want to use my feed, which is tomwoods.com/podcast/feed. That's the feed. Okay, that'll take you to the feed. But you do not want to use FeedBurner. FeedBurner, terrible. Terrible, don't touch it. tomwoods.com/podcast/feed. If you're using the feed and you use that FeedBurner one and you don't know how to get the episodes anymore, so now you're just listening on the site, that's what's going on. FeedBurner's terrible. Use my feed at tomwoods.com/podcast/feed. All right, David Henderson tomorrow. Lots of fun. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.